Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 32. Re-enchanted, Medievalism, Children's Literature, and Fantasy, where we will be talking with Maria Sachiko-Cesari about how minor literatures are bringing enchantment back to modern audiences, and at what costs. For joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. My co-host today is Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing and author of several Harry Potter essays. Emily, what do you think about Re-Enchanted? I know you and I have both been poring over the book. What do you think of Maria's book?
I am loving it so far. I'm learning a lot, and it's really interesting. There's a lot that pertains to my field of religious studies and the way religion, the role of religion in the popular imagination has progressed or evolved or changed over time. And and I'm particularly, I just finished the chapter on Christmas, and I just absolutely loved that chapter. So yeah, this is going to be a must read for a lot of our listeners.
Yeah, so we will be talking more about the whole idea of Christmas and children's fantasy, and that's a big topic and very timely for this time of year.
Oh, yes.
All right, let me introduce now the author of that book, our special guest today, Dr. Maria Sachiko-Cesari, Associate Professor of Literature and Founding Director of the Center for Experimental Humanities at Bard College, which is dedicated to exploring how technologies mediate what it means to be human. A graduate of the University of Chicago and a Rhodes Scholar, she received her MA and PhD from Oxford University. Dr. Cesari is interested in pushing at traditional boundaries around the scholarly practices, texts, and cultural norms that have long dominated the humanities. Fusing several of her interests, Dr. Cesari's latest book is Re-Enchanted, The Rise of Children's Fantasy Literature in the 20th Century from University of Minnesota Press, and it is just out this month, December 2019. Thanks for being on the podcast, Maria.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm really interested to hear all about this. This book, for our listeners, this book is something that I think you're all going to want to definitely get a copy of for yourself. I just tore through it. What a great book. And it gives you a lot of the backstory on children's fantasy literature in the 20th century and why so much of it has especially these medieval themes and the kind of origins, especially with Tolkien and Lewis. So we will be talking a lot about that. But let's start with the essential question. The preface of your book makes it clear that you were a young reader of fantasy literature. And what are your earliest memories of reading fantasy?
You know, I think the first really strong memory I have of reading fantasy was reading the Chronicles of Narnia. I was one of those kids who got to be really good at walking with their peripheral vision because I'd be walking and reading.
That is a special skill.
It's like a deep nerdery skill, which I still have.
I was going to say, life skill.
yes, on the way to class. But I, when I was in the third grade, I had, you know, because of standardized testing and other weird things, ended up in a class where I had the teacher gave me the opportunity to really just do kind of what I wanted because I had advanced past what most of the curriculum was at the time. And so she let me just sit in the back of the room for most of the year and just read books. And so I remember just being kind of ensconced in this little kid-sized couch and tearing through all of the Narnia books. and just being completely transported out of this public school elementary classroom into another universe and absolutely loving it. And that's what I think, one of the things that really sparked this obsession I had with fairy tales. I read every book of fairy tales in my elementary school library, and then I made my parents truck me around to every public library in our town. I read everything. I really loved them. So I would say even more than fantasy, I loved fairy tales, fairy stories, although Narnia was a really important starting point for me.
You know, that I think that's a common trajectory. I definitely love fairy tales when I was a kid, and I see it also in my children, where the teacher maybe doesn't always know what to do with them, and so they say, "You're welcome to just read some of these." And I think, to me, that's a great source of education, and especially the Narnia books. I think they're like the gateway drug of children's fantasy.
Wasn't there some fantasy author who said, if you want smart children, read them fairy tales, or have them read fairy tales if you want to raise you know, really intelligent children. So, and I mean, I think with everything Tolkien has said in on fairy stories, you know, it's like the link between, you know, it is that gateway, you know, the fairy tales and then Narnia, and then, you know, so that makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did you read Harry Potter when you were young or when you were an adult, Maria?
Well, they were coming out when I was, I guess I was a teenager, and I had friends that were really interested in them. But at that point in my life, I wasn't very interested in fantasy. And this is actually because of something I mentioned in my preface, which happened to me when I was around maybe 9 or 10 years old. I came inside from playing outside and went to the bathroom and was washing my hands and caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror. And I had this like sudden, stunning revelation that was both totally crushing and totally embarrassing at how obvious it was, which is that I don't look anything like all of the characters that I have read about. And, you know, I'm half Japanese, half Italian, grew up in America, so really grew up enmeshed in Anglo-American culture, but suddenly recognized that, you know, I would never be a blonde hair, blue-eyed fairy princess, and felt like all of the wonderful things that would come along with looking like that, or looking like the children that make their way into magical worlds, suddenly felt just blatantly, obviously outside the realm of possibility for me. And it was just this really crushing moment of, you know, realization. And one thing that's really struck me is that as I get older, and especially now that I teach, how many young people of color have a moment like that. And actually, in my preface, I call it the moment because that's what a student called it when she was talking about her own decision to study children's literature. And in particular, she was looking at African-American representation in children's literature, because it is so widespread, that feeling of alienation from the books that you love, the worlds that you dreamed about, and the kind of vistas you'd hope to someday, you know, step onto as an adult, and just suddenly feeling adrift. So for me, you know, that actually caused a break in my reading of fairy stories and fantasy. I don't know if I intentionally did it or not, but really at that point I stopped for a while. And so it didn't really come to Harry Potter until college. And actually in many ways it was because, you know, I had friends who really liked it, but I was sort of skeptical. But I took a course which was really thinking about these questions of why medievalisms are so prevalent in children's literature. And that was a question that really resonated with me because of my experiences, my own passion for them, and then my own sense of alienation from them. So, you know, I really, of course, really enjoyed reading the Harry Potter books, like so many people, but I came to them as a college student and then was reading them as an adult, and really thinking about them simultaneously through a critical lens, at the same time as reading them as just a reader.
That's really interesting. I don't think I have heard quite so frequently as a story. Emily, I don't know about you, but I think most of the people that we've talked to have come to Harry Potter as, you know, something fun that they're reading, you know, some escape or something like that. And to have you reading it as you are thinking about it critically, having had this experience of feeling alienated from the very Anglo-centric medieval fantasy style that seems to be encapsulated in it. I haven't really heard that one before. Emily, have you heard?
No, it's like the, what do they call it? The hermeneutic of suspicion, you know, rereading it, you know, I mean, not to say, you know, you're expecting it to not be good, but, you know, yeah, it is. That's a valuable perspective.
I just think, you know, as a literature scholar or a literature student, often you learn to read or watch or consume on multiple levels at the same time, where you can kind of be in something and enjoy it, but there's also a part of your mind mm-hmm. that's processing and thinking through. And now, of course, I chose this for my works, you know, my life's work, so I enjoy it, you know, but I do think it's actually can be a really exciting and stimulating way of connecting to literature.
Right. And I think it's so interesting that you are thinking about it in the medieval context also right away, which I think sometimes the medievalism, and you sort of suggest this, there's an almost unconscious medievalism that is adopted in these fantasy stories. And we sometimes don't even separate it out from the fantasy.
Yeah, the professor in that course at Chicago, his name is Michael Murren. He asked this question that just blew me away, which was, why would you prefer a quill pen in a world where you could use a ballpoint pen? Mm-hmm. And I said, right. Oh my God, right? I mean, a quill pen's so cool, but incredibly inconvenient. And so,
right, that's never addressed in Harry Potter. Like, damn it, my quill pen.
Yeah, like literally just get a package of Bix, you know? That kind of question really started a whole lot of thinking for me. You know, what do you get out of using a quill pen that's different from using a ballpoint pen?
So let's talk a little bit about medievalism and children's literature. They're both regarded as minor literatures, as you say, and yet you see them as reflecting really important aspects of the modern adult experience. How do they do that as marginalized literary forms?
Yeah, thank you for that question. You know, the title of my introduction is called Magic in the Minor. And, you know, one of the things I'm really interested in this book, and also more broadly, is the way that things that often get maligned or treated as not as important, and you gestured towards this in your generous introduction, how central those things actually are to the functionings of everyday life. And in particular, I was really interested in the ideas of childhood and European Middle Ages, and the way that both of them end up being often dismissed as, you know, not central and not nearly as central and as important as something like adulthood and modernity for kind of contemporary experience. But in fact, both of them are treated as the origins of Western adult subjectivity, that, you know, we are who we are as adults because of what happened to us as children, and we are who we are as, you know, the modern world because of this quote unquote dark ages that happened before. And so this, both of them kind of fit into a model of thinking about the world as always moving through kind of linear progressions towards improvements, which I don't know that I necessarily agree with, but it's a very common idea that, you know, things evolve towards the better over time. Narratives of progress, and particularly towards rationalism. Mm-hmm. So both of these things, childhood and the Middle Ages, function in this way, and they are kind of the silent foil for so much of what we agree to be part of the importance of everyday modern experience. But at the same time, people really want space for magic, enchantment, belief, and these sites, childhood and the Middle Ages, seem to offer this connection between the present and our quote-unquote origins in the past, where there was an opportunity for this kind of magic and enchantment and belief. And fantasy does this, especially children's fantasy, does this amazing sleight of hand where it brings together childhood, medievalism, magic, and binds them up in fiction in a way that provides access to all of these things at once. And, you know, of course, fantasy literature and children's fantasy literature are perhaps like the most minor forms of, or maybe not the most, but among the most minor forms of fiction in terms of how they're regarded in the academy. Up until really Harry Potter, it was pretty embarrassing for a lot of people to be adults to be seen reading fantasy. But in these texts, there's so much about what people care about and wonder about in terms of who they are as Western subjects. So I think that's, you know, kind of really crucial to how they become so important. And then also, you know, since Freud, since psychoanalysis, in the age of self-help, we really believe that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we are products of our childhoods. And so in that sense, as Umberto Eco puts it, we are what we read. And if you grow up reading this kind of literature, much like my own experience, you end up casting forward visions of the future, expectations of who you think you might be, ideas about what you think the world is going to be like based on the reading that you do, at least in, you know, to a certain extent. And so in that sense, these books, which are seen as kind of trivial and maybe not so important, end up laying the foundation for so many people's expectations, indeed whole cultures' expectations for what they should be like and what they used to be like and what that means for what they're going to be like going forward.
Yeah, wow, that is so cool. And it's just amazing to me how entwined all of those things can become in these particular literatures. I've said this a few times on the podcast, but I did a sort of one-off class. It was like a January term class called Representing the Middle Ages from Mort d'Arthur to Monty Python. And in that, I was really trying to look at what are some of the things we've lumped into the Middle Ages. I think the Middle Ages becomes a sort of fertile ground for us to put a lot of things back onto it that were not necessarily characteristic of the real Middle Ages. Something about the paucity of sources or the lack of always clear structures, you know, that allow us to put in a lot of things that are of our own imaginings. And I'm really fascinated by this idea that the Middle Ages then becomes like our collective childhood as people who are modern Westerners. And one of the things that you talk about in that is that it's also then represented as a comparable time of innocence. And that that is another way that it can connect with children's literature through that, that idea that there's something more innocent about the Middle Ages.
I was fascinated by the role of, as I was saying when we first started, I was fascinated by the role of religious belief, religious type belief, you know, belief in those things for which we have no empirical proof, and how that was such a feature of the Middle Ages, such a normative feature of the Middle Ages, to believe in things that, you know, are handed down instead of things based on, you know, scientific, you know, observable fact. And how that is still so often expressed in now the arena of popular culture, instead of in the religious arena. So that was fascinating to me, as the Middle Ages as kind of a, you know, a cipher for that longing, which we have in, you know, in childhood, and we indulge in childhood, but doesn't really go away. And shapes now how we express that longing. You know, if you think about the kind of mythic stories that we enjoy, even as adults, you know, in our current age, where these huge mythic stories are so popular in the cinema and in popular fiction, you know, Game of Thrones type of, you know, and I know you address those in the book, but fascinating.
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, one thing that really strikes me is that the Middle Ages is called the Middle Ages at all. I mean, people living during that time weren't thinking, wow, I'm right in the middle of the two other things, right? that title was given to it after the fact. And to me, what's so fascinating is the way in which the Middle Ages functions as this kind of dark gap between these two lights of the classical world and European Enlightenment. And so, you know, kind of as you're suggesting, Emily, there's this notion that in between these two lights of rationalism was this kind of mysterious space for belief, for magic, for, you know, it's also a time of maybe fewer sources, as you suggest, Katie. But it ends up becoming this gathering place for all kinds of hopes and dreams and fears. And, you know, I call it a psychological landscape in one of the chapters of my book, because of the way it ends up being this place for kind of working out and playing through so many, you know, suppressed desires or fears or hopes and beliefs in ways that other kind of temporal settings don't always work. And, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about fantasy, you know, as you're kind of suggesting, Katie, is that the Middle Ages ends up becoming like really broad. It just becomes like olden times.
Right. It's generic. It's the generic Middle Ages.
Exactly. And the historical like realities of the Middle Ages become really less interesting in many cases than the ways in which that period seems capable of containing all of these concerns and desires that we have.
Yeah, and as a historian, I mean, I do still find the actual history interesting, but but I'm very interested in like popular understandings and representations of history. I would really say that's the field that I'm most interested in. And so that's one of the reasons I think that the Middle Ages, you know, I think you're absolutely right to see it as this psychological landscape that is at once a historical period that in some ways bears very little resemblance to our like popular associations, our social memory of what that time period was. And, you know, I was really interested, you know, I've sort of mentioned innocence, and Emily brought up a kind of religious belief. Our producer, Laurie Beckoff, had come on the show to talk about medievalism and violence. And you mentioned the importance of the, you know, Middle Ages as a repository for fears. And it is a violent age as well, where there's maybe less restraint, and that the Middle Ages then becomes this place where you can locate a lot of those violent impulses that maybe, you know, that are, I hope, frowned upon more in the, you know, rationalist world of 21st century.
Absolutely. And I think that's true for a lot of other kinds of categories that are maybe officially less smiled upon today. You know, you think about the strict hierarchies. Do I actually want to live under a monarchy? Heck no. But these worlds are all structured around the often returns of rightful kings and bloodlines, aristocracies. That's something in reality I would have absolutely no desire for. But there's a kind of comforting, engaging whole universe of possibilities when you're kind of thinking through the eyes of those people. And the same goes for hierarchies of gender, a world where, you know, men are men and women know their place, when in fact the Middle Ages was much more complex, as you know. And sometimes I think that fantasy set in these kind of medieval otherworlds provide opportunities for starker hierarchies of knowing our place in the world that can feel innocent in a way that they kind of strip some of the complexity of real experience, both today and in the past. And I think there can be a pleasure in that. And, you know, and that also has to do with, you know, racial and colonial issues, which I know we'll get to later. And so that's not to say that reading fantasy makes you a bad person. But I do think for a long time, the genre, which of course is changing very much now, but for a long time, the genre has been a place to kind of indulge or think through or spend time with these other kinds of beliefs and desires that are really latent in Western culture.
So this brings us to the question of whether we should really be considering a lot of this fantasy medievalist literature, like the Middle Earth Saga or the Chronicles of Narnia, and of course, Harry Potter. Should we be talking about those as children's literature?
Well, that's a really fun question, because there's so much discourse in childhood studies about, you know, what is children's literature? This iconic piece by Jacqueline Rose about the impossibility of children's literature, you know, African-American literature is usually written by African-American writers, and women's literature is often written by women, but children's literature is very rarely written by children.
That's a great point.
So children's literature is a really vexed category. But I mean, if we just take it in terms of, you know, what we every day assume it to be, I think, yes, if I think these authors chose to write children's literature in many cases, but I think it's more to do with how we treat the category of children's literature. If we continue to trivialize it and see it only as a kind of unimportant writing and reading, then we do it a disservice. If we say that, oh, this is actually an important set of books, and so we're going to raise it out of that category, I think that also does it a disservice. And this is all complicated by the fact that, you know, many of the key authors that we're talking about had really ambivalent or contradictory feelings, or maybe their publishers did in some cases, about what should be considered children's literature and what shouldn't. So, for example, J.R.R. Tolkien later wrote that he was sorry that he had written The Hobbit as a children's book, and explained in an interview that I dug up that he only did it because at the time, writing in the 1930s, you know, which is like the height of the boom of modernism, if you want to tell that kind of story and not be laughed at, the only way to do it is to publish it as children's literature. And he corrected it later when he had the opportunity to write a sequel, which of course became The Lord of the Rings, which was published for adults. And, you know, Narnia
it was written as children's literature. C.S. Lewis is unapologetic about writing it as children's literature, but he makes these kinds of passionate defenses of children's literature as continuously relevant, and particularly fantastical literature as continuously relevant into adulthood. He uses metaphor of trees adding rings. So mm-hmm. you add on to the things that you love in childhood as you become an adult. You don't chug along from one station to the next, leaving things behind like a train, which is a very, very Lewisian metaphor, right? This kind of natural metaphor for a good thing versus
the modernist train. I love that.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, right.
And then, you know, we have things like Harry Potter, which are published for children initially, not necessarily written or intended only for children, but then published for children, and then, you know, quickly becomes what we now call a crossover phenomenon. So I think it really is about a bigger question of, you know, what are the kinds of writing and kinds of ideas that we culturally designate as more appropriate for children? And what does it mean to recognize that adults and, you know, young adults and much older adults are very interested in those kinds of questions and ways of writing as well?
I love the metaphor of the tree that you've put forward there. And I think a lot of the adults who love Harry Potter, who I've come across, and especially people who did grow up with the series and are now adults, I think that that metaphor resonates. You know, it's mm-hmm. a way of thinking about how the other reading that you do is really, what would you say, is growing around those earlier experiences.
Those core experiences stay with you and act as the foundation for the other material that you read and add on to your canon.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that people are often concerned, I think especially scholars, that if you say that's for children, it's an easy way to dismiss not only the literature itself, but the love that people have for that literature, and also people's ability to apply an important critical lens to that literature, right? It's only for kids. And, you know, what do we think? Let's try to figure this out. How can we avoid that problem? Is it possible to avoid that problem? Are there just some people who are never going to be able to think of criticism of children's literature as a valid kind of scholarship? Or is there something that we can do as scholars in this field?
What, to get people to take children's literature more seriously?
Yeah.
May he rest in peace, but there's always going to be the Howard Blooms of the world, right?
Right.
But I think, I mean, I do think Harry Potter is different, especially, you know, in looking at it compared to Narnia, because in the series, all the main characters grow up, and this is a good thing. Like this is a value in the narrative. Whereas in Narnia, when the Pevensies get older, you know, oh my gosh, Susan starts putting on lipstick and she's just written off in the story, you know, as their growing up is seen as a loss of that childlike ability to believe in something that there's no empirical evidence for. Whereas Harry finally grows up in the series. The moment he comes of age, really, in the series is when Dumbledore says to him, Harry, you wonderful boy, you good man, or whatever he says at the end in King's Cross Station. He says, you wonderful boy, and then he calls him a man. And that's the moment, because he has learned to identify with his consciousness. And instead, you know, instead of embracing the material world, he embraces what's on the inside, you know, what's in your head instead of what looks real, you know. And so I do think that growing up is considered of more of a value in Harry Potter than it is in Narnia. I'm just riffing here.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know if that's why. I think sometimes people try to justify Harry Potter as, well, by the end, it's not really a children's series anymore. You know what I mean? People will say, like, by the end, those are really books for adults. Maybe this is how people think of The Lord of the Rings, too. I'm not really sure, but certainly my child did not stop, you know, before he got to book 5, which is, to me, one of the more adult books. Children are, in fact, reading and engaging with them. And I don't know. I mean, I think maybe that's a good question. Is growing up considered important? Does it see that kind of trajectory, and does it take it seriously? On the other hand, I keep thinking about this idea that, you know, medievalism and children's lit are both projecting a kind of a past, a special place for childhood, and that that's in reaction against some kind of progress that's happening later on. So I'm not sure. Maria, what do you think? You want to chime in?
Yeah, I mean, this is some of the core questions of children's literature studies today, I think, even going back to the 80s, the piece I mentioned before, the impossibility of children's literature piece, really argues that a lot of what children's literature does, and more broadly, the ways in which we address childhood, does more for adults than it does for children. Mm-hmm. And it's more about prescribing for children the kind of performances we would like them to do for us, mm-hmm. and the kind of spaces we want them to hold open for us as adults. And often this kind of preservation of innocence and cries to do things for the children in terms of preventing their knowledge or asking them to repel certain kinds of knowledge is really more about adult desire than children's interests or needs. I mean, as some people have pointed out, I think very convincingly, most children, their desire is to grow up. It's our desire to keep them children. Mm-hmm. And what is that for? Why do we want to do that? What does it do for us? And so there's a kind of double-sided, there are two sides to this question that we're talking about. One is whether or not children's literature should be the way it has been for a long time, which is essentially a kind of balance of didacticism, teaching children how to perform childhood and how to be people that are socialized into society in the ways that we want them to be. Earlier forms of children's literature were really explicit about the ways in which they wanted children to perform childhood. But even today, it's very absolutist, usually. I think that when I teach children's literature and childhood, that's probably one of the most difficult courses for my students to get their heads around, just because it requires an essential breaking down of all the assumptions we carry around with us about children. And our cultural material often creates these cultural assumptions and teaches children how to be the people that reflect our cultural assumptions. But even today, a lot of our children's literature is still very explicit about that. I mean, for example, you kind of can't find a children's book today that advocates a entirely docile, non-fun-loving child who just follows everyone's directions. That would be like the 18th century book. But now our norms are such that that can't be the case.
I hadn't really thought about it that way. I definitely understood the teaching part of children's literature, but I had not really thought about it teaching them how to perform childhood in a way that is actually supposed to be doing something for adults, which is that right. is really important to think about as adults are the ones writing the children's literature.
Right. Yeah. Right. That goes back to that important point of, the fact that this is kind of necessarily prescriptive for them, which is, not something I'd really thought of before,
right.
in terms of how we categorize the whole genre. Well, one of the authors I look at in my book is also Philip Pullman, who
right.
in many ways positioned his Dark Materials trilogy as a kind of anti-Narnia, where knowledge is a good and the loss of various kinds of innocence, including sexual innocence, are also goods, as opposed to evils or things that take you away from realms of enchantment. And he was pretty intentional about trying to undo the work of previous fantasy in that trilogy. I think there are authors who are thinking about this. YA, of course, has been trying to reimagine how we write to and for young people for a long time. And Harry Potter is interesting in that it kind of transitions from the early books as really children's literature to what we might call young adult literature by the end.
I think it's worth thinking about children's literature for those things that it's doing. And then I do also think that the really good ones do work and are complete as literature and are worth mm-hmm. talking about in that way. And I know Emily's participated in a new Harry Potter volume that hopefully will be coming out in the next year or so that is looking at Harry Potter in a particularly literary way. And maybe the more we do that kind of thing, the more it does show that that's true scholarship. Well, let's take
right.
a look at Harry Potter's Genesis.
Genealogy.
It's genealogy.
Yeah.
That's a good word.
Yeah.
As an inheritor of the British fantasy traditions that J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis particularly crafted at Oxford. So help us make the connection, Maria. What is the connection between Tolkien, Lewis, And not only Harry Potter, but really what you talk about is the whole Oxford School of Children's Literature in the 20th century.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm basically making this argument in my book that children's fantasy literature, as we come to know it by the turn of the century, emerges out of essentially a failed academic experiment that C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien tried to push through at the University of Oxford, where they were both working in the 20s and 30s, and really for the first half of the 20th century. But it did end up having this incredible outsized impact on popular culture, if not on intellectual or academic culture, in the ways that they had hoped. So, you know, you can just look at Harry Potter and see these obvious connections to things like Narnia and the Middle-earth books, these kind of cozy Britishness, dragons, castles, literary and religious allusions, this notion that the past is alive and relevant and full of lessons for now, right? All of that kind of thing. And also, of course, children or small people, minor individuals end up being key players in these perilous realms and these massive quests. These are things that are kind of run through a lot of children's fantasy literature. And I was looking back at the different authors who were writing in this mode when I was in college, actually, and noticed that a number of them had gone to Oxford as undergraduates, which, you know, in and of itself maybe is not that surprising because, you know, Oxford and Cambridge are the two most prestigious universities in the UK. And so, you know, maybe it stands to reason that some of these big authors would have gone to these schools. But it was striking that it was Oxford and not Cambridge. And so that made me interested to find out more about what was going on there. And as I was doing my research, I discovered, you know, everyone seems to know that Tolkien and Lewis were friends, that they were part of the Inklings group. They wrote their fiction and poetry and shared it amongst themselves. But they didn't just restrict their activities to the extracurricular. They also, you know, at the time that they were, you know, becoming friends and starting to do this writing together, they were in the midst of huge amount of change in terms of what English departments were doing really all over the Anglophone world. And most people don't realize that English as a field is very young. It's only really been around for a little over 100 years in higher education in terms of like the giving of formal degrees. And people have a long time been trying to figure out what it's for and who should be studying it and what it should be doing. And so in the early 20th century, there was this big shift towards what modernism. So T.S. Eliot, Virginia Woolf, Gertrude Stein, or that kind of literature, which now, of course, forms the bedrock of a lot of contemporary literary studies and also a lot of contemporary literary aesthetics, these kind of notions of ambiguity and certain kinds of realism as being really what we see as literary or high fiction or high literature. And Tolkien and Lewis were just not into it. They were very much products of their upbringing in the 19th century, but in particular, you know, they bonded around their love of the Middle Ages, their dreams of enchantments, and the ideas of deep cultural traditions. And they essentially overhauled the undergraduate curriculum at Oxford to make it a curriculum that did what they loved, which was primarily medieval literature, at a time when all the other curricula were drifting away towards becoming what most curricula are now today, where the medieval is kind of maybe an option or maybe not there at all. Whereas for their curriculum, it was absolutely central. Every student who did English had to learn Old English as well as Middle English and spent most of their time in those areas before ending their curriculum at 1830.
Nothing good comes after 1830.
Yeah, they're like really unimportant.
You got trains now. It's not, none of that's any good anymore.
Yeah. Exactly. Interesting theory. That's like actually not a bad point. But then the texts they were picking from the Middle Ages were also very fantastical. Things like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, mm-hmm. which is a kind of mysterious green man who comes into Arthur's court demanding a Christmas challenge. Sir Orfeo's travel to the fairyland. Mandeville's Travels, which is this kind of way of seeing travel narrative in fantastical terms. And so they were picking these, and of course, the Morte d'Arthur, so King Arthur and his stories. So the text that they were choosing and requiring all of these undergraduates to read ended up popping up in the writing by people who studied that curriculum. People like Susan Cooper, who wrote The Dark is Rising series, Diana Wynne Jones, who wrote many, many, many children's fantasy works. Philip Pullman studied under this curriculum. And also I write about Kevin Crossley Holland, who is maybe better known in the UK, but who's also written on Arthur and is himself a translator of Old English. And so I got really interested in this and started to follow it and started calling them the Oxford School of Children's Fantasy Literature, these people who are maybe not even intentionally working together, but producing this kind of children's writing that is magical. It is grounded in actual medieval texts and full of this reverence for enchantment and the medieval past. I mean, we have a really interesting counterpoint in T.H. White's Sword in the Stone and Once a Future King, mm-hmm. which is a much more like jolly romp through the Middle Ages, makes fun of it a lot, reverent in a loving way, but also kind of, you know, pokes fun at the Middle Ages a lot. And White went to Cambridge, and Cambridge was one of those
of
institutions that was, yeah, really turning away from thinking about the medieval in this way.
I love that it's all about curriculum, Maria. I know. The power of the syllabus, the power of the undergraduate syllabus.
We cannot help ourselves.
Can I have a question about that, Maria, if you know. How did these two wield this kind of power? Was it because of their publication success? Or, I mean, what gave these two such influence? Or did they just force it, you know, because they were kind of that kind of, I mean, I could see, you know, from everything I've read about Tolkien, I could see him kind of being that squeaky wheel that gets the grease. Or what insights do you know about, you know, who fought them and why they lost?
So this is great for any faculty politics. Let's hear it. What are successful strategies?
And so our listeners know, I mean, in this book, you know, Maria is like presenting their, such this interesting perspective on, you know, this influence that Lewis and Tolkien had, not just through their publications, but through this curriculum. And she's like, you know, these passing references to, in her book too, in the faculty notes from the faculty meeting of May of 19, you know, 30, whatever, you know, it says, I'm like, wow, that research. So talk about, if you can, why they had this kind of influence and what kind of research you had to do to sort of uncover this.
Yeah, these are, yeah, so interesting. So one of the elements is that Tolkien gets hired in as a professor of Anglo-Saxon, as they called it at the time. So now we would call the professor of Old English, at a very young age. So he had gone to Oxford as an undergraduate, then went away for World War I, and then worked at the University of Leeds, and then comes back as a professor, which today we're like, yeah, okay, I'm a professor, you're a professor. But at the time, and for a long time, and in some cases still today in the UK, to receive the title of professor is incredibly hard and rare. So he gets kind of vaulted up at a very young age to an extremely influential position in a very young English faculty. English was very secondary to classics still in terms of the humanities. And so he ended up having actually a huge amount of power. It was really interesting. So, Emily, I spent a lot of time in the archives at Oxford, at Cambridge. Also, I went to University College London to be looking at the ways in which this syllabi were developed. And, you know, the best way to do that is, my friends, to look at the faculty minutes from their meetings, which doesn't give you everything, but gives you quite a lot. So it unfortunately, it doesn't tell you who they were arguing against and who voted for what. But we do see in letters. So Lewis wrote about the syllabus, which my party and I have forced upon the junto after much hard fighting. So the sense of there being these real embattled sides on who was fighting for what kind of curriculum at that time. It was also really interesting. There's E.M.W. Tilliard, who was at Cambridge. He wrote a book which was very explicit about the shift in curriculum over there. And you can see in the way that happened. And again, it was really often driven by very few people because of the size of the departments, and really emerged out of the strong opinions of a few people who cared a lot. And so in the case of Tolkien, he just from the beginning, I mean, essentially said, the reason that there are not more students choosing to study early material is because we don't have enough instruction in it. And that was never borne out, even as they offered more and more instruction in early material. Students overwhelmingly opted to take the most modern of the tracks offered at Oxford, time and time again. But Tolkien was sure that what really needed it was just more medievals.
if you build better. It, they will come.
Yes, yeah, just better medieval instruction.
I do find it continues to be true today that it is really the people who care the most who are going to carry whatever it is through. Yes. So one of the things that you talk about is you have this quote from your book, and I thought I would just read it. This book reveals how Tolkien and Lewis led the charge in a two-pronged attack, both within and outside the academy, on the disenchantment, relativism, ambiguity, and progressivism they saw in modernity. It describes how they effectively wielded the unlikely weapons of medievalism in childhood and follows the lasting outcomes of their campaign. I just love that idea that they are, I just imagine them almost like medieval knights, you know, charging along.
Yeah.
We are going to, you know, give you something else besides this disenchantment, this modernism. And I think our fellow, you know, podcaster on Reading, Writing, Rolling, John Granger, he also really resonates with the anti-modernist sentiments of a lot of the medievalist fantasy. You have this other phrase that I love, where this children's fantasy is re-enchanting the world through magical medievalisms, and the idea that that can actually do something to kind of bring magic back into a world that has maybe grown up past it and thinks that it doesn't need it anymore.
Yeah, Tolkien uses this phrase, relegated to the nursery, to talk about fairy stories in particular, but more broadly about these ways of thinking and believing that you're talking about. And he, you know, argues that they have been relegated to the nursery or treated as trivial or childish in the ways that we've been discussing wrongly. And it doesn't mean that they're not important, but that they've not become, they've moved out of fashion. And the language of fashion is just absolutely shot through their writing when it comes to talking about curriculum and literature and its directions. They're really strong sense that this kind of trends in literary production have left behind what they think is really important. And so their curriculum really reflects this and tries to push back against it and ground their undergraduates in a different kind of writing and different kinds of systems of belief. And it's important to note that, you know, of course, there were courses in medieval literature, you know, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, but that was mostly coming out of the field of philology, which Tolkien was a philologist, but often using medieval texts really just as exemplars, so ways of looking at early language and to mine it for different kinds of linguistic information, as opposed to reading it as literature. Mm-hmm. And one of the real innovations of the Oxford curriculum was that they not only, you know, stuffed it full of magical, fantastical medieval literature, but they demanded their students to think about it as literature and as literary texts with meanings that had continuous relevance over time. And I was looking at some of the English examinations from the time when they started, as well as during the years when several of the authors I study were sitting those exams. And you really get a sense of, you know, the kinds of questions they were asking. You know, write about fairy in Middle English literature. It's like they want people to be, for your examination, for whether or not you're going to pass your degree at Oxford, tell me about fairyland.
That question is so right up Tolkien's alley.
Yeah,
so
right. Definitely wrote that question.
And I love how in your book you do talk about the you know, the final exam questions that certain of these Oxford School writers would have had on their examinations. And I just think that's really fun to see the undergraduate experience having this effect on the literature that people like I think Cooper, you talk about, would have written eventually. So
And so, Maria, I want to go back to what you call, because you called this a failed experiment. This Lewis and Tolkien's kind of Oxford School approach of putting, you know, the medievalist literature or the medieval literature at the center of the education and insisting on these on this approach to their curriculum. I kind of want to push back on the whole idea that this is a failed experiment. I think I know what you mean in terms of it didn't actually stick. you know, people didn't, you know, flock to their approach. But there was this core group, and it's brilliant in your book how you go through and talk about these different authors like Susan Cooper, Diana Wynne Jones, and these various others who had such great success in engaging with these medieval and kind of deep past sources to very successfully publish kind of in the same vein as Tolkien and Lewis. Maybe to say a few words about what you mean by that failed experiment and is there kind of a flip side to that?
Oh, I 100% agree with everything you're saying. I mean failed in the sense that other institutions didn't pick it up, that you don't see Harvard saying, you know what, you're right. That's what we should put at the center of our English curriculum. You know, and instead that everyone else just keeps going in the direction of modernism and Oxford really gets left behind. But it is profoundly successful in popular culture, like beyond probably their imagination. Actually, I don't want to speak for their imagination. They had very, very big imaginations. So in that sense, it absolutely worked. You know, and we see that also as kind of a surprise, maybe inheritance of a combination of their academic work or their administrative work as administrators at a university and their writing as fiction authors, because many of these children's fantasy writers who, you know, attended Oxford were reading Tolkien and Lewis's writing. So there's a kind of combination of, you know, reading the source material that Tolkien and Lewis were interested in, and then reading the translation of that source material into children's and popular fantasy. And then that spawning a whole genre, really. When we say fantasy, of course, there was fantastical literature for a long time, but the norms of the fantasy genre in kind of the novel form that we know of it today really, I mean, emerges from Tolkien's work and to a certain extent Lewis's as well, particularly in the children's category.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's so interesting how you basically are mapping out like this is the language of children's fantasy as it was constructed by Tolkien and Lewis, not only through their own writings in that genre, but also through this, you know, study of medieval literatures, and that they are creating vocabulary, they're creating like common settings and common themes. I just think that comes through in such a rich way. And again, I think people should definitely read your book, Reenchanted, because it is going to concretize, you know, some things that people have intuitively sensed about these literatures. But I think it draws the line from the one to the other in a way that is really brilliant. Now,
thank
appropriate
you.
To our season, and one of the things that I think is also like amazingly resonant in all of this, you have a whole chapter on Christmas. Why is Christmas at the thematic center of these cultural ideas about the medieval past, childhood, and enchantment? And how does Christmas itself get bound up in these different literatures?
I love writing about Christmas. This was just like, I could not stop myself, and I ended up becoming a whole chapter. But one thing that was really wonderful as I was doing my research, noticing how many children's fantasy works have a significant Christmas portion or even write the whole book around Christmas. I'm thinking of Cooper's Dark is Rising. Also, all of the Harry Potter books have a Christmas element. Of course, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is all about the return of Father Christmas. And before the spring can come, it's always winter, never Christmas under the White Witch's realm. So the kind of recurrence of Christmas was striking to me. And one thing I discovered as I was doing this research is the way in which all of the elements that I'm talking about in my book, about the magic of the minor, the ways in which medievalism and childhood and enchantments, which are so kind of trivialized in contemporary culture, actually end up being so important, are echoed directly in the annual Christmas holiday. And so I don't know who those people are, but for those people who are like, this is kind of niche, this is just if you're interested in children's fantasy, I would encourage them to look up and look around. And Christmas is this incredible cultural example of how significant these marginalized categories are to the very functioning of the rest of the year and the ways in which people understand themselves. Mm. So, you know, all of the things I'm writing about my book. So in addition to magic, medievalism, and childhood, but also the urge to reenchant modernity through fictions, the way that political, institutional, cultural power structures get reinforced through these movements, all these things are captured and coded in the Anglo-American Christmas holiday. So, you know, for example, think about belief in Santa, which if you have children in the room, you may want to remove them. the way in which we, as culturally, work together to maintain a fiction that we insist our children believe, for the most part, and even to the point where I would actually give a warning on a podcast that people may want to pause.
Yeah, right. Exhibit A.
We are all so invested in the maintenance of this fiction together, and the way in which this fiction engenders a form of belief in our children that then gives us satisfaction and joy, and then we catch a little bit of their enchantment through their belief in this thing that we no longer believe. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, a kind of example of the way in which fantasy still functions in this kind of really real everyday way. Santa Claus himself is a kind of medieval story that was transformed in many ways. And I write about this a lot in my book about how that happens, but makes us feel connected to a deep, timeless past, our origins, you know, as Western subjects. But of course, is a really transformed and much changed for modern reasons kinds of story. And then also Santa Claus ends up being this figure that, while all about childhood and enchantment and connection to the past, also has profound relevance for the functioning of everyday life because of the ways in which Santa Claus serves as this figure that essentially launders enormous economic activity during the holiday season and transforms it into a sign of love. When I'm sure people are feeling the love while they're doing the Christmas purchases, but at the same time, Santa Claus serves as this figure that launders that all of those purchases into a, I can't remember exactly the phrase I used before. If I had talked about the laundering.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
It's relevant. He launders the fact that this is a huge economic boost. I mean, this is economic activity is what it is. And he turns it into something that's more magical.
Exactly. So yes. So Santa Claus serves as this figure who also, you know, transforms all of this gift giving, all of this purchasing into just a pure sign of love, when in fact it is also a really important boost to the economy. The return to everyday life after Christmas, the kind of blues of the end of that magical period, is also accompanied with gigantic credit card bills. And those credit card bills are part of the functioning of the global economy. All of the ways in which Christmas actually captures and reflects the kinds of elements we see in children's fantasy, I think helps to make the argument that what we see children's fantasy doing often is not just limited to one genre of literature for young people, but actually really central to the way that people live in the Western world and think and behave. So Christmas, for me, helps to reveal how widespread the kind of tendencies that I'm unpicking in the book are, even beyond children's fantasy literature.
Right. This is not niche. We're doing all of these. We're evoking all of these things all the time, whether we're readers of Tolkien and Rowling or not. I think that's one of the things that's really fascinating, and becoming a little, you know, self-aware of those issues. One of the things that's interesting, of course, Christmas is a religious holiday, and yet a lot of the performance of Christmas has been quite secularized. You know, it's this cultural phenomenon that, as you said, has this really important economic role. And I'm remembering again the idea of religion, and in this secular age, what are we doing in terms of religion and belief? I'm just sort of interested in that idea. Now, let's connect it as we sort of think about that. I threw that out, and I'm not going to let anybody reply to it, but you can later.
That's cool, Katie.
Fantasy tales, as you mentioned, like, they do have these Christmas moments. This is literally the setting in Narnia, is always winter, never Christmas. And then Harry Potter, I was thinking about this. You talk a lot about Harry's first Christmas and the, you know, his having a chance to have that kind of Victorian style Christmas that he never got with the Dursleys, you know, who are giving him like a Kleenex for Christmas. I can't even remember if he got that.
Uncle Vernon's old socks.
Uncle Vernon's old socks, right. And yet then that is the time in which he discovers the mirror of Erised and also has to get beyond it. And it just struck me as you were talking about, you know, Christmas is over and you've got the blues and the credit card bill rolls in, that's a little bit of the same emotional experience that Harry Potter has when he's not supposed to dwell on dreams, you know, anymore in that Christmas season. Right.
Yeah. I mean, and the chapter about Christmas is actually really a chapter about spaces of childhood and the ways in which children's literature has for a long time carved out these discrete spaces for children and for childhood, whether it's a secret garden or the wild, you know, the kind of riverbank of the Wind in the Willows. And you see that in the way that the Christmas holiday creates this kind of magical place almost out of the time of year. And Harry Potter really captures that, especially in the first book, where, you know, he, for the first time in his life, he experiences a true space of childhood as we would imagine it in the Anglo-American tradition, where he has safety, he has love, he has fulfillment, he has friends, he's connected to tradition, all in these ways that are like incredibly fulfilling. And on top of it, you have this kind of outside it's cold and warm, inside it's warm, and that kind of cozy sense of outsides and insides. And he's really snug on the inside in that first book. But as you note, you know, there's the Mirror of Erised, which is also gives a sense of what it means to be seeking connection with the past and with your family and your roots. And for Harry, that's a sad thing because of his position as an orphan. And but I think it's really important because it also establishes how much Christmas is a time of remembrance, and also historically has been a time for when the walls between the living and the other world have been thin. So really up until recently, ghost stories were a really common part of the Christmas holiday.
Fascinating.
Yeah, you know that Most Wonderful Time of the Year song? There's this line, you know.
Scary stories.
Yeah. Parties for Rosie. And then scary ghost stories. What?
Yeah.
And if you know, things like Dickens wrote lots of ghost stories.
It's like Scrooge.
We remember. Yeah, exactly. Remember the one, but he wrote a lot of them. And so there's this kind of long history of Christmas being this kind of Halloween-like period as well. And so I think it's really lovely that you get that encoded in the first book. But then kind of thinking about what Katie was saying before about how Harry grows up over the course of the books, each of the Christmases after that, they really start to shift. I would say especially starting with The Goblet of Fire, where you kind of move out of this place of just being with people you love and getting cool presents and eating lots of great food to these other kinds of anxieties come in, romantic anxieties and how do you look and how do you feel? And by the time you get to the seventh book, it's a very, I guess I would say, adult Christmas in some ways, right? You know, kind of take the enchantment that you can and a time that, of great struggle. And so I do think that the Christmases transform and reflect the ways that at least we think about how people of different ages might have relationships to this holiday, which, as you say, is a religious holiday. And so it shouldn't necessarily change as you change in your age. But because of how it really became a children's holiday, really only in the early 19th century, it now has really different emotions for us at different points in our life.
Thinking about that last Christmas that Harry has when he and Hermione are literally in the graveyard at Godric's Hollow, and Hermione realizes it's Christmas. And when we're talking about ghost stories, I love that. And especially if you think about it in comparison with the Mirror of Erised, which is a kind of, those are kind of ghosts as well. There's definitely a lot to say about that. Emily, what are your thoughts? Yeah, you were telling us you have many thoughts about this.
I do have lots of thoughts about it, and I'm wondering who's written about Christmas in Harry Potter. Like, it has to have been a thing. Somebody's had to have done some articles, some studies on that. But I find, you know, in the fact that last Christmas in Deathly Hallows is so horrific, and because they're in the graveyard and they have this really nice kind of moment of catharsis for Harry with regard to his parents' death. They visit the site of his parents' death, you know, for the first time for him. And then they go to Bathilda Bagshot's house and they have this horrific, scary experience. And his holly wand is broken at that time. And so he has this thing that wards off evil, with him at all times, and he loses this. He can't rely on this anymore. So it's a really interesting thing. But Maria, one of the most fascinating things that you said in your chapter about Christmas to me was, you know, you're talking about Christmas as this space, this kind of liminal space between worlds. And yet it also has a history of being a liminal space between classes, where you have these observances of gift giving to servants to kind of afford their goodwill, you know, so that you can have some of their, you know, continued goodwill. But how this shifts with the focus on children, it shifts to gift giving to your own children, which has this kind of self-absorbed effect of keeping your wealth in the family. And, you know, I mean, I've just written an article for Katie, and I've both been working toward this Ivory Tower and Harry Potter Volume 2. And I've just written this one on parenting, and about how, you know, sometimes parenting is just really an exercise in self-regard. You know, it's a narcissistic practice. It can be a very narcissistic practice. And it's interesting to me that there's this shift from this outward focus of kind of extra charity to a lower class to exercising that charity towards your own instead. And I find that really interesting in terms of just the cultural progression of Christmas, if we can call it progress. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of this comes from Stephen Nissenbaum's book, The Battle for Christmas, which I just read like a page turning thriller. He's a historian. So interesting in terms of, you know, how many of the kind of like childhood, how many of the cultural norms around Christmas we just do not know the history of. And this was really striking to me as well, and really coincides with this instantiation or this creation of the idea of childhood as this special divine force that holds our kind of enchanted possibility for us. So we kind of like literally reward our children for being that as we give them gifts at the holidays. And, you know, what gets lost instead, what's the tradition that it emerges out of, as you say, it's actually giving to the poor in your community. And so people were still giving money to the poor, but they were doing it through philanthropy, so writing checks. Whereas it used to be like, people would come into your house and you would spend time with them, and they would eat your food and drink your drinks. And so it's really a kind of ends up, shifting that sort of kinship and sense of relationship to dependence onto really just thinking about your own kid and keeping it all inside your own household.
I loved what you said about wassailing as the Black Friday shopping as the new wassailing. That's so true. I don't get the Black Friday shopping, and I can't imagine why that would be pleasurable for people. But yeah, I can see that kind of the keeping of the odd hours, going to odd places at odd times, the kind of revelry of it. I'm sure some people include
the
drinking
carnival
that.
Aspect. Yeah,
a fist fight over towels.
Yeah, right. The possibility of danger. Dangerous, you know, but it's so boring compared to, you know, like I would so much rather go out singing hymns in my neighborhood. I've been trying to get somebody to do that with me for the last several years. I've been kind of like floating the idea, and everyone just looks at me like, really?
Really? That would be fun. I would totally do that with you, Emily.
I know, Katie.
Well, I will say, even the hymn singing is a pretty sanitized version of wassailing, because, you know, it wasn't really singing hymns. It was like, if you think about We Wish You a Merry Christmas, it's like, bring me some figgy pudding. Bring it out here.
Right.
You know, they weren't songs that necessarily of religious nature. They were like, give me some stuff right now. It was more like Halloween in many ways. And actually, where I live, we have a tradition amongst some of my colleagues and friends where they do punk rock caroling. And that, I think, is a bit more like wassailing. You go and like shout punk rock songs at people's houses while drinking a lot of alcohol. So, yeah, that kind of sense of...
I'd be down for that too, Maria. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, I've had to tone it down since I've had a kid. But that sense of like real revelry, carnival, topsy-turviness, I think that goes back deeply to midwinter celebrations, you know, before even necessarily Christian associations.
So now I think we've got the warm feeling of Christmas, and I did love the Christmas chapter. So evocative. And, you know, I don't know who's done Christmas and Harry Potter, but some people need to be on that. I think there's probably lots of things that could be said about the Christmases, maybe the ordering of them, but also, I mean, so many of these issues that you've talked about, and I think we could bring some really good insights to that.
A holly wand. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's so resonant because holly, of course, is one of the kinds of greens that have traditionally been used to ward off evil, as you were kind of mentioning.
Right.
So to lose your holly wand on Christmas is pretty notable.
Well, and it's that strong association with Christmas as a Christmas decoration, and it's got those associations with Christ. And so I've written about that, Maria. I will send it to you.
Yes.
Now, let's talk about something that is sort of an underlying political concern, I think, that comes from this merging of medieval English past, or it's not even the real past, right? It's medievalism, necessarily, and with children's fantasy. And this goes back to, you know, the moment that you described, which is this realization that this is very much an Anglo-centric view of now not only the past, but desires for the present and magic and the possibility for enchantment. How is the genre of children's fantasy presenting this Anglo past and identity? And what's the effect of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the Oxford School, particularly really in the traditions of children's fantasy up until the 21st century, where I think there has been a lot of change recently, intentionally or not, a lot of this literature creates a sense that enchantment comes from Western traditions, and usually it's white, culturally British or American children are the ones who can access magic. And a lot of this, you know, can be explained. People write about what they know, and, you know, that stands to reason, I suppose. But in addition to this Anglo-centricity in the settings and the characters, there's also the ways in which other ethnicities and their magic tends to be dangerous or even evil that needs to be fought against. You know, needs to be harnessed for the good of the white characters' experiences or aims. And so in that sense, it kind of really encodes a kind of Orientalism that, you know, when you're talking about stories that are often focused on saving the entire world, but the way to save the world is only through the actions of culturally Eurocentric or Anglo-American figures in worlds that look like the English Middle Ages, it really makes a message about who has the power to make a difference in the world. And the integration also of kind of long-standing forms of racism, again, intentionally or not, I think really end up creating the sense that these kinds of opportunities for magic, for changing the world, for doing things for a greater good, they really only belong to a certain small subset of people on the planet, and that subset of the people who've had it for a long time, and, you know, in particular, emerge out of, I argue, a kind of sense, displaced sense of British colonialism. I mean, I think it's really striking that Tolkien and Lewis are writing, you know, perhaps, you know, the bulk of their fantasy writing emerges in the 1950s at this moment when the British Empire is really on the wane. Everyone knows it's ending. And their writing creates these worlds that are pre-colonial, necessarily pre-colonial because of their medievalist setting, but then imagine these new vistas for exploration, these new lands for conquering. And I talk about them in terms of empires of the mind, these places where children can go and, you know, implicitly white children, usually boys, really often following in the kind of narratives of 19th century imperialist boys literature, and that kind of adventuring and traveling, mapping, encounters with other peoples can be treated in this, again, quote unquote, innocent way that doesn't have to deal with the political realities of what actual historical experiences of that wrought on indigenous peoples, kind of the horrors of transatlantic slavery, all of those things that you don't have to deal with that, but you can just enjoy the exploration, the conquering, the battles, without having to think about that. And, you know, I think if you come from a certain background, you start to think about it eventually.
Yeah, and you don't know this, Maria, but I am currently working on a chapter for the anthology that Emily mentioned, The Ivory Tower and Harry Potter, Volume 2, that is actually looking at J.K. Rowling's parody histories on Pottermore, which is now wizardingworld.com, and the way that her, because she's taking on a particular genre style, she, I think, ends up reinforcing a lot of colonialist understandings of the past, particularly the North American past. Yeah. And she takes that on partly because of the literature that she has, but also partly because I think that she too is a part of a generation at a different end point of the British Empire. Harry Potter comes out 1997, which is when Hong Kong goes back sort of to China. So there's this kind of interesting confluence of like the very end of the British Empire at the same time Harry Potter 1 comes out. And I think that, you know, she's late empire. She's got some of those same, I think maybe, I think they're unexamined ideas about Britain's role in the world that get expressed through Quidditch through the ages, but also I think these kind of parody histories. So I'm working on that.
And Fantastic Beasts.
And Fantastic Beasts. Oh, for
yeah.
sure, right? Because and she's gotten a lot of fan criticism on the basis of these, and I think your understanding of how the children's fantasy literature genre, you know, has a lot of these expectations, these assumptions embedded in it. To me, that really resonated with these other writings that I'm looking at, you know, that there's something in the form, there's something in the expectations of the genre and the tropes that lead you in these directions, that they are kind of empire of the mind, right? That they're shaping your consciousness, your ability to imagine in a way that maybe would be even outside of that.
And can I just say, I find it a whole lot easier to forgive this aspect of the writing in Lewis and Tolkien. And I find it more troubling in Rowling because it occurs so much later in history. And so I've been really struggling with that. I mean, you know, Katie, since reading your article and hearing your ideas on this, and then, you know, hearing some of these same things in Maria's book, it is very troubling. I read Harry Potter kind of differently now, which is obviously it's a good thing to, you know, read with your eyes wide open, but it's a struggle.
Right. And I think, you know, J.K. Rowling's conscious mind is to be, you know, diverse and inclusive. And she, you know, she consciously values those principles.
Right.
And that is why I feel as though there is this kind of, you know, this blind spot is what I call it. There's this inability to see how, you know, what you think is just you writing this literature is actually going against some of those deeply held values. And that's partly why it's disappointing to me too. I don't necessarily know, and although I'm sure a lot of people have talked about it, you know, Lewis and Tolkien's particular views on those issues, but J.K. Rowling is so outspoken, in fact, about inclusion. And
right.
I can see she's trying. She, in some ways, I don't know, does she not have the tools that she's trying in the wrong ways? And maybe she's not the right person to do it. You know, you were talking, Maria, about, you know, sometimes people, you know, you're going to write what you know, or you may have some vantage point that maybe you can't get beyond in your writing. And I know that there have been lots of really good examples of children's fantasy that have recently come out that are, I think, a corrective to some of that Anglocentrism. I'm not sure what you're thinking on that is, Maria.
Absolutely. I agree. And, you know, I guess the other side of empires of the mind, which is how I describe this medievalist children's fantasy that we've seen for a long time, is what Zeta Elliott, who's an author, calls decolonizing your mind. And the problem with a lot of people who want to write more inclusive literature, you know, and again, this is not like individual personal critique, but is that often people just literally do not have the knowledge, the history, the capacity to begin to imagine, you know, the foundations from which to imagine other worlds. you know, we think about all of that went into that Oxford curriculum to give people the grounding, and then generations of people reading those kinds of literatures, and now they're just walking around these repositories full of ideas and knowledge and images they can pull on when they sit down to write their own material. I mean, how many of us are walking around with just chock full of West African mythology and stories that we can draw upon? Not many of us if we came out of an Anglo-American educational system.
But you've got Tomi Adeyemi, who's, you know, she's building it, right? So the idea that then you're going to get somebody who does have a has a connection in there who can maybe start to build that for the future.
Exactly. We saw, you know, Nnedi Okorafor has been working on this for a long time as well. And there's a whole emergence of, you know, East Asian authors, authors coming from Middle Eastern backgrounds. There's just like a wide array of other kinds of fantasy now hitting the market. And I think a lot of it actually has to do with, you know, comps, basically, publishers saying, oh, wow, this sold. I guess we can publish some more. But it wasn't that there weren't people who had stories to tell or ways of imagining enchantment or deep histories outside of the Western tradition. It's that it wasn't being published. And we're just really in a moment now. I mean, a lot of the books that have just come out, I don't have in my book because they were literally coming out as I was doing proofs. It was, you know, really exciting. But there's just so much happening in that space now. And I think that it's one of the lovely things about the kind of genre that Tolkien and Lewis helped to kick off was this way of looking deep into mythologies and histories, the land, and using that as a foundation point for imagining other worlds and other possibilities. And there's no rule that says it has to be the English Middle Ages. That is the origin point, you know? And so that's a lot of potential there.
Absolutely. And, you know, you're making me think, too, Amy Sturgis does all of this with Indigenous Futurisms and Rebecca Roan Morse's novels. And we're sort of trying to get together a show where we would talk about some of these, you know, alternate sources of fantasy imagery in children's literature. Although a lot of these are not even, I would necessarily qualify as children's literature, maybe like what you said, like maybe more young adult, but even adult in some ways. So when we're thinking about J.K. Rowling in this trajectory of children's fantasy, especially sort of coming from the Oxford medieval curriculum, do you see Rowling doing things differently? I mean, I know Pullman, you mentioned, and you talk about him a lot in the book too. Pullman is, you know, building off of the same ideas, but he's also subverting them in some ways at the same time. Where do you see Rowling in that, you know, that continuum?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, she obviously holds very progressive values on her own. And her book, I think, tries to encode those. You know, she sees them as this argument for inclusion and diversity. And I think the way it ends up kind of turning up in her books, which, as you know, they come out in the 90s. So maybe there's a little bit of a difference there, but there really reflects a kind of melting pot type narrative, the sort of light multiculturalism where like, Lee Jordan's black, you know, Angelina, you know, she's just black. So there are these characters of color, but they're just kind of like English, really, happen to be racially different, but who we don't really like explore or think about what it means to be, you know, of Indian extraction at Hogwarts. I mean, I feel like there's a lot to say there, you know, but it's not really integrated. Instead, she takes up issues around racism through the kind of pureblood, muggle, kind of lineage.
It's a little safer ground, maybe, for her.
It's much easier to kind of take a stand one side or the other and then to be like, oh, but like in this magical world, like the races are all treated the same. And I think that's maybe wishful thinking. I would have loved to see that get complicated a bit more. You know, as you say, maybe it's not something that she has a kind of background in or felt was, you know, important to the trajectory of the books. But, you know, in the end, it's these characters of color are also fighting to preserve Britain embodied in the Hogwarts castle. You know what I mean? Like they're coming together around this medieval symbol. And that's really not complicated at all. It's one thing I would say is, you know, as I told you at the beginning, I read a lot of things now, watch a lot of things now with this double vision. I can really enjoy it and then also be like thinking, what's going on with that at the back of my mind? And I think that often for students and a lot of people, we feel like if you find out something about a book or a text that you love is something you don't agree with, then you feel embarrassed, like you're a bad person, that you have to either like staunchly defend this text or you have to like recognize that you're a horrible human being and give it up forever. And I don't think that either of those things, you know, it's too stark a binary, right? We are complicated people that are, all of us are in the process of learning and trying to be better, more equitable all the time. And I'm sure that's true of Rowling as well. And so, you know, for me, I think a lot of the joy of literary analysis is not just like poking holes in things and being like racist, but helping to think about what's going on underneath it. What are the bigger pressures or movements? And in many ways, Rowling is part of a trajectory, not that I believe in, you know, linear narratives necessarily, but where we do see over the course of the 20th century and into the 21st, fantasy really starting to transform in many ways. And one of the ways it transforms is suggesting that the underlying narratives don't have to be Western medieval narratives.
Right, right. Well, and you know, I was thinking about the work of Laura Spazzali, showing how, you know, fiction reading in general helps people with perspective taking and with building empathy in young people. But he looked specifically at Harry Potter and its really marked ability to do this for young readers. So while Rowling does not address experiences of different races and cultures within Hogwarts so much, you know, that overarching conflict between the purebloods and the more muggle-loving characters and the defense of muggles and muggle-born wizards and witches does seem to have a similar effect to on readers in terms of perspective taking, you know. So yeah, it is fascinating. But I am really glad to hear you say the thing about, you know, you don't have to just throw this out as soon as you, because I've really right. I have had trouble with those Pottermore readings. It's kind of kept me off Pottermore. Because I don't want to confront that. I don't want to, you know, have to deal with that. So maybe I should just dive back in.
No, I will read anything that Rowling writes. I will. And I agree. Like, just because you see it critically does not mean that you cannot also love it. And I think Harry Potter fans/scholars often live in that, you know, that in-between realm where we love it. And then we got some things to say about it.
Yeah, one thing I say to my students is if you love a book so much and think it's that great, then you should treat it with respect and think that it can stand up to critical analysis.
Right.
And that pressure is something that it can handle. If it's too delicate to stand up to something like that, maybe you don't really believe in it as much as you think that you do.
Ooh, I love that line.
I like that. Very I'm applying good. That to some of the Bible stories that we read in my class. So
yeah,
I
absolutely.
Like that. I like that.
Well, yeah. Maria, we come to the conclusion of our podcast today. What advice would you have for scholars or, you know, people who are fans who are maybe looking to engage critically with the text, people who are doing research, especially in these minor and undervalued areas of children's literature, fantasy literature, and specifically Harry Potter scholarship? What advice would you have for them, especially in the academy, but maybe also in general?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of two parts to this. If you're talking specifically about the academy in particular in the American context, you know, there are not a lot of jobs in the professoriate, end of story, and right. in terms of literature. And so they're incredibly hard to get. And the truth is that still the universities have not changed very much in the kind of categories that they use to hire people. And so, you know, putting all of your eggs in the childhood or fantasy studies basket can be a very risky thing to do. I started out as a, you know, medievalist. I moved into the work that I'm doing and I really believe in it. And I think that you can believe in it, but I do think on a practical level, you do have to be able to demonstrate the ways in which what you do is part of a larger conversation. And in particular, that you're able to teach and do work in areas that are valued in the academy. So it really is a kind of like very strategic game in that sense. That said, I do think that's important that you don't let that scenario silo you and you don't silo yourself. There are really lovely conversations going on between scholars in the worlds of medievalism and fantasy and childhood, and those are really valuable and enriching conversations to have. But at the same time, as we were kind of talking about earlier, too often when those of us who agree this is important just stick to ourselves and say, well, this is important, this is important, yes, this is important, we maybe lose the opportunity to help other people learn about how what we're doing is important on much larger stages. What is the bigger conversation that you think needs having around these texts? How might we have them with people outside of our quote-unquote minor areas of study? So in that sense, I would also encourage people to dream big and be ambitious. Don't feel like what you do is, you know, only for you and the other Harry Potter scholars out there. Yes, them, but also what can, you know, in my case, modernism studies or institutional studies, 21st century literary fiction, what can people who study those things, can they learn from what you're doing? And I think that you'll find, you know, as we were just saying, the texts that we believe in, they do have a lot to say about these much bigger questions. And helping the academy, helping wider culture to take them more seriously, in many cases, it's on us to help demonstrate and draw the lines between what we do and these bigger conversations that need to be had.
What a wonderful note to end our podcast on today.
Great advice.
Wow, that's wonderful. Total agreement there. And also something for me to shoot for as well. I think, you know, it's good advice all around. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Maria Sachiko-Cicere, for being on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun. And I learned a lot from talking with you all too.
Oh yeah, good. I know. I do enjoy, you know, the setting as a way to do a little bit of what you're talking about, bring in other people. And I also hope that our listeners are feeling like they are also participating in a, you know, in a dialogue here as they participate with us, especially through social media. I really think that, you know, you've helped us to contextualize Harry Potter in the realm of 20th century children's fantasy and to think critically about its origins. I will definitely be thinking about your book a lot. And I know our listeners, you definitely want a copy of Maria's book. It's called Reenchanted, The Rise of Children's Fantasy Literature in the 20th Century. And as you can tell, it is full of all kinds of interesting topics that are building on the same basic theme, but really, really interesting, thought-provoking, and I guarantee that this is just a really good read. And that is from University of Minnesota Press. So Maria, I think your book it's just coming out this month, December 2019, right?
That's right. Makes a great holiday gift. Oh,
absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely, for sure. Thanks to you, Emily, for being our expert guest today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And Maria, congratulations on the book. It's really great. Thanks so much.
I'd also like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thanks for all that you do for us, Emma. As always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. It's been 20 amazing years, y'all. And to Lori Beckoff, our MuggleNet liaison and producer. Lori's medievalism expertise helped us to find you, Maria, and brought your book to our notice. And so we are particularly grateful to Lori for that. Thanks, Lori. Dear listeners, we are also glad that you joined us, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. Participate in our conversation. Share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. And now I will leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.